Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 196 from May 25th, 2009, The Flesh-Colored Tapes. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2 and follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by GoToMyPC. Skip the rush hour traffic and save time, money, and frustration by working from home with GoToMyPC. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMyPC.com/twit. It's time for TWiT, This Week in Tech, the show that covers all things tech and a few things Twitter and so forth. And that's John C. Dvorak already registering his disgust.
I'm just registering my amusement.
John's in his country home right now, enjoying the Memorial Day weekend. Happy Memorial Day weekend, John.
Thank you. Same to you. It's very nice up here today.
I bet it is. It's nice everywhere, isn't it? It's required. End of May is supposed to be nice. We used to have a regular barbecue on Memorial Day. Also with us, I'm really pleased, I think for the first time on TWiT, Dan Bricklin, who is a pioneer in software, the guy who created VisiCalc about 8,000 years ago. It seems like...
30 years ago.
You know, 30 years isn't that long ago, but in computer terms, it's ages.
It's half your life.
Yeah. Dan, I'm so glad to have you on. Look at this shot we've got of Dan. If you're watching the video, this is professional. This is how, John, you're being put to shame.
Hey, so, Dan, do you have a black cloth, felt cloth behind you? What's the deal?
I sure do. Want me to zoom out?
Yeah, let's see.
Let's see the whole set.
Let's zoom out here.
He's doing all of it. He's doing the Charlie Rose thing.
Yeah, let's see. You can see I have my...
Oh, the illusion is destroyed.
Yeah, I have a backlight up there, you know, and a light over there.
So do you do a lot of video? I mean, why is it that you have this great setup?
It was an interesting story. I wanted to do a video about copyright, open source, stuff like that. And I had a choice, either pay a videographer to do it or do it myself. So what I did is I taught a videographer how to blog. In return, he told me what to buy and set up my studio for me here in my office.
Idea. What a great idea.
So I ended up buying all this cool equipment, which ended up being my initial podcasting equipment also.
That's very cool. Mm. And now, you know, you could be doing what I'm doing. You could be doing 24/7 Bricklin TV.
Oh, sure. It's hard work.
It is hard work.
There's only one maniac in the world.
Well, there isn't, unfortunately. Somebody called me on the radio show, said, Leo, I want to start the first 24/7 internet network. And I said, well, you may not be the first. What is it about? Twitter.
Oh, my God.
And I said, God bless you. Good luck.
Well, in Twitter, you know, you have a little hole about this big that you can see things through. It's, you know, not HD. It's very small.
Yes. So I can't wait. I want to talk to you about your new book, Bricklin on Technology, about what you've been up to, about blogging. I mean, and so forth. But I guess kind of traditionally on Twit, we go through news stories, too. So we're going to do a pro forma look at the week's news. Okay. And then I want to grill Dan Bricklin. Yeah, you can download VisiCalc now. It's like 64K.
Less. It ran in less. It's like, what, 20, 30K? Because it had a run in 64K with all of the data.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Plus the OS, plus the screen buffer.
What year was that?
Well, the original VisiCalc came out in 1979. It was announced, a few weeks from now, 30 years ago.
So this is the anniversary.
This year's the anniversary.
Wow.
A couple weeks ago was the first time it was shown privately to the computer press. That was at the West Coast Computer Fair. And then it was shown publicly in early June at the National Computer Conference in New York and shipped in October of 79. And the version that you can download is a little more advanced. It was an early version of the IBM PC version that we shipped right when the IBM PC came out.
But the first version was Apple II.
Yep.
In fact, it was the first, the original killer app. It was the program. Yep. There you go. It was the program that made the Apple II succeed as a business tool.
Yes, it already had succeeded as a game tool and for other things.
Yeah. Yeah, people were playing Choplifter, and then they said, wow, you can induce, you could, well, and nobody, well, we're going to get into this, because nobody had ever heard of a spreadsheet before. I mean, there were paper spreadsheets, but the idea of doing it on a computer was brand new. Really cool. And yes, you can get the executable. What am I saying? It's on Brooklyn.com. You have it. You offer it.
Yep. I got permission from IBM Lotus to let you download it.
Oh, that's really, did they buy it?
Well, our company was eventually bought by Lotus, which was eventually bought by IBM, and IBM gave us permission to put that
up. That's neat. All right, news stories, and there are a couple of Twitter ones. So, John, if you want to just walk away from it right now, you can. I won't blame you.
Actually, these particular stories interest me.
I think it's kind of interesting, too. Lance Armstrong, who is a very active Twitterer, actually kind of pissed off the press. He's in the tour of Italy right now. And he Twitters a lot. And in fact, to the point now where he refuses to speak to the media after the time trials on Thursday, he went right to the fans and refused to talk to the Italian media. Now, you don't do that to Italian media. They had a tantrum. They said, well, that's it. We're not covering you. Sections of Italian and English speaking media announced they will no longer report on Armstrong's messages because he won't talk to them. He says, I'll talk to you, but I like Twittering. Remember when he broke his arm?
Probably from Twittering.
Don't Twitter while you bike. But I think he Twittered it before anybody knew, and it was like a couple hours. So, before it made the media. So I think that, what is this, disintermediation, John? I mean, is this kind of...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's a really good example of it. I don't know how far it's going to get, but I know a lot of people that, you know, use Twitter as a source of news, breaking news in particular. And the thing you're going to see is one of these days, CBS is going to be reporting from somebody, I mean, they'll be reporting or using Twitter or somebody doing some tweets as a source, which will be kind of interesting, kind of like as free stringers. The thing you have to note, which I think is slightly objectionable, is that when people start picking up on using this as a news source, they're not going to be paying anybody. And in the olden days, they would.
You mean the stringers would get paid?
Yeah. These guys, you know, Twitter is just going to, you know, it's going to be bragging rights.
Yeah, well, you get what you pay for. 140 characters, how much?
I don't know. If you happen to be the only one there who's on the spot, I can see you starting to, you'll do an auction right on the spot and say, who am I going to direct message to?
That's what happens with photos, isn't it?
Right. Look what happened to the guy. The first photos were tweeted, right? Yeah. Of that plane that fell in, that went into the
miracle
river
on the Hudson. Yeah.
Yep.
But he didn't get any money for it. But you're saying that, in fact, this one might be a road to revenue for Twitter. they could set up an auction.
Yeah, well, immediately whoever is there is going to get a tweet from a from an agent, and the agent's going to say, "Hey, I'll get you a good deal."
That's unbelievable.
Once it becomes that's the way that it is. I mean, it takes a while to do it.
There've been stories going around that Twitter is finally going to figure out how to monetize. They're going to start charging companies to be on Twitter. Do companies stick around if they get charged? I guess they do. I guess you have to be there. I wouldn't pay for it.
Depends on how much. Yeah, well, if it's a dollar a month, I mean, what?
Well, yeah, it depends how much.
The problem.
Yeah.
It depends on what it is they give you for that.
Yeah, I mean, they can't prevent Comcast from being on Twitter. They'd have to give them something. And I'll tell you, Twitter doesn't have a lot to give right now. Its infrastructure is terrible. Its search isn't working again. They just don't seem to be able to scale this thing at all.
But if you pay them, maybe they'll let you have the secret account. That
maybe
is
it'll work. Yeah. Pay us, we'll make
They're
it work.
They're just getting you used to having it at a low level. They can really move it up if they want.
No fail wells. $5 a month. Come on. The other story from Twitter is that kind of surprising. United, well, maybe not. Maybe this is the kind of thing that companies would pay for. United Airlines is offering deals to Twitterers, according to Mashable. United Airlines is tweeting what they call twares. Oh, God.
Terrible.
Special fares if you follow them on Twitter. Hurry, it says, and get your first ever time-sensitive tware. $63 one way, Chicago to D.C. plus tax. Additional terms, and then they give a tiny URL. Book soon. Again, I think this is probably a good way not only to build followers, which is of value, but also to... you know, build a clientele.
Can you imagine what's the ad? I'm sorry. What's the ad thing for that? If you wanted to sign on,
I don't know. It just at United Airlines. One word at United Airlines. I guess you could follow them.
Yeah, I will.
Well, that's the thing. Won't everybody? Right. And this is
really, people who travel.
Yeah.
Right.
If you sign up for a company's email deals, then you would sign up for this.
But this can be really fast. I mean, they could tweet to people in line or something like that. Do you want to upgrade or whatever? They could, all sorts of cool things.
Well, it's also valuable for, you know, airlines. There's nothing staler than an unsold airline seat. Yeah. This would be a great way. They could do their own consolidation, you know. We've got five seats left to the flight to Singapore. You get down to the airport in 1 hour.
Do auctions.
Yeah.
I'm in.
All right. That was it. That's the Twitter. Unless I come up with something else, that's the Twitter.
No. You don't have to come up with anything else, Leo. Those were great.
Hey, did you see the Sunday funnies? There was on one of them at least. It was all about Twitter.
Oh dear.
Yep.
Oh,
at least in the Boston Globe, it was.
This is an interesting article from a guy named Jeff Chappelle, who was a software analyst. That's his name of his blog, Jeff Chappelle, software analyst. Only thing missing is frontier software analyst. But he makes an interesting point. He says that we've always said that, well, if you want 4 gigs or more of RAM, you should go 64-bit OS. 32-bit versions of Windows won't support more than 3-some gigs of RAM because some of it's reserved for video space and so forth. He says, you know, because of PAE, every version of Windows will work with more than 4 gigs of RAM. Microsoft just turns it off.
Oh, really?
Well, you know, and there's been some dissent. I kind of posted this on FriendFeed and got some expert input. People said, well, PAE, which is I can't remember what it stands for. It's basically that segmentation. Remember, this is something that's been part of Intel. I'm sure, Dan, when you moved to the Intel processor, you had to live with this. Physical address extension is the idea, I guess, of segmentation.
Yeah.
And, it does, you know, yeah, the address registers are 32 bits. That would top out at 4 gigs, but you can segment, page it effectively, and see much more. And it works just fine. In fact, this guy removed some registry code and was able to get Windows 32 to see 8 gigs of RAM. No problem.
So does he have the registry fix posted?
Yeah. Yeah, it's on his site. Now, he says, I didn't do any testing for speed and stuff. But he said it works. He shows, you know, the picture of it. He shows it all working.
Well, at least that dialogue box works.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's the question. Do you have any experience with PAE, Dan? And does this seem credible?
Well, it seems credible to be able to make parts of something know about more memory and use different ways. I mean, segmentation goes back to my, you know, college days and stuff. But, you know, to test it, I mean, it may be the same code. It might not be the same code. And anyway, they can charge. I mean, this goes way back. IBM used to have a thing where if you cut one wire, some of their machines would suddenly run faster. This goes back 40, 50 years.
Great.
And that way they could ship the one machine and you just paid for whatever speed you wanted.
Intel did that with the Celeron. They disabled the L2 cache.
Right. So, you know, that's just how much you want to pay for it. The fact that they've already shipped it. Is that any different than somebody sending you trialware and then sending you a code to turn it on?
No, I guess the thing that would upset me is that it's been widely, you know, bruited about that. Oh, no, it's a 32-bit operating system. It cannot access more than 4 gigs And you have to have 64-bit if you want to do 4 gigs or more. And if that's not technically true, if it's just a license issue, then that's not quite honest. I mean, if there's a technical reason it can run in, run more RAM, then they should say, well, we don't license it for more RAM. They're not going to do that, I understand. But
yeah, I don't know, it may be more complicated than that. But that's, I'm not into the kernel of and the differences of all those. I spend much more time client-side working with Ajax and stuff like that.
Isn't that funny now how that's changed? I mean, hacking now is really much higher level than it used to be.
Well, there are different places to do it, and being able to run on all different machines has its advantages, and you have to sort of pick where you want to spend your time.
Right.
And I decided to spend my time much more in a lot of the open source languages and client side and things like that for a while. By the way, I found that URL. If you go to comics.com/jump_start.
Oh, Jumpstart.
Jumpstart. Yeah, go to them. Today's comic is about a guy getting arrested, and he wants his handcuffs off so he can tweet that he was arrested.
Worked for, who was it? The guy got arrested, the student got arrested in Egypt. The blogger got arrested in Egypt, and he tweeted about it. Worked for him. Oh, that's so funny. Oh, that's so funny. Would you mind removing my handcuffs? I have to tweet. You should have thought about that at home. Officers, I got a tweet as soon as possible. You're just going to have to hold it. Actually, tweeting involves his PDA. He tells his pals what he's up to all during his day. Sounds stupid and boring. This guy looks kind of like you, John.
Hey.
Usually it is, but today was different. I got busted by the cops. Anything you tweet can and will be used against you. That's pretty funny, I guess.
So the first time I've seen a full Twitter comic on a major comic.
It shows it's mainstream enough that people would, who read comic pages, funny pages would get it. I mean, that the general audience would get it. I guess it is. Once Oprah starts talking about something.
Let's go back to something Dan said, which is that the idea that you can clip a wire on an IBM computer and then the speed triples, or somebody you about, about the amount of memory you can access through pagination, or however you want to describe it, is the same as trialware, which is something I disagree with that concept, because trialware is something you sign on to. It's just essentially to try something, and then they give you a code to use it after you either pay for it or something. I mean, it's a process. It's not like somebody tricking you. It's not as though you bought something, product A, and it turns out to be trialware, and after you've paid for it, you have to go through some rigmarole. So I don't think that analogy is very good. I was mulling it over there.
Took him a while.
Yeah, I meant it in terms of you only have to ship it once, so you don't have to have something else come in. You can right away get instant gratification in terms of them being able to give you the improvement that you want. Remember, some of the things you get are, you have the free version, and then you download a code like Eudora or something, and then suddenly you get
it opens up a box.
Right. Well, Windows Vista does that. When you get that disk with Windows Vista, it's got every version on it. And if you want to, that actually was pretty smart. Microsoft, you're sitting there, you're saying, "Gosh, I really need Ultimate." It's there. You got it. All you have to do is get a code and then unlock it. So I guess in that respect, although. It doesn't. You can't turn it into 64-bit Windows. You got to reinstall that.
I just find it disturbing that Microsoft, essentially. I don't understand these multiple. I mean, is there one best Windows Vista? And why do we need all these, these little SKUs. Ones that are?
Well, they're going to pretty much do the same thing again. Although with Windows 7, although my buddy Paul Thurrott, and we'll talk about it on Windows Weekly this week. Got a little scoop. Microsoft said there's going to be a Windows 7 Starter Edition, pretty much intended for developing nations, that will have, it'll be cheap, but you can only run 3 applications at the same time. You try to launch a fourth, they'll say, sorry, you can't do that with this version.
Yeah, no, we've talked about that on Cranky Geeks, actually. I think it's, ridiculous.
Well, they back down. You were right. According to Paul Thurrott, Microsoft has taken that restriction out.
Cool.
I don't. Guess
John,
it's ridiculous.
I agree with you on that one.
Is it ridiculous? I mean, really? Come on. If we want to make a cheap version for developing nations,
Oh, you know, that's just another excuse to, you know, to it's just a rationalization because, you know, Microsoft overcharges for its products and everybody knows it by now. I mean, when you can get, you want something cheap for developing nations, take, give them a copy of Ubuntu and some reference machine.
That's a good point.
And it's free. And you can get, use Abbeysoft, AbbeyWord.
Yeah, that's it's a good point.
It's a beautiful clone of Windows Word 2003. And there's, you know, they've got the browsers and all the rest of it's all there.
Yeah, why not just, yeah, why not use a free operating system? Really, in fact, they shouldn't use the phrase developing nations. It's really intended for the pirating nations. That's who it's meant for.
Places where they can't charge the full price.
Right. Places where it's, well, look at China. I mean,
places where you use a dollar. It's a dollar. You go to the store. It's not openly sold in most of the Southeast Asian area. You get the disc. It's a dollar. In fact, they have, you know, the most expensive version I've ever seen. One time it was in, I think it was in Kuala Lumpur, I saw, and it was a store in a mall, and they had a copy. I thought it was really one of the more interesting bootlegs. It was a copy of up to, I think it was up to XP at the time, every single version of Microsoft DOS and Windows.
Oh, so I wish you'd DOS picked that up for me. I could have used that.
Thinking about it, I probably should have grabbed
one. Yeah, that'd be really
DOS
handy.
DOS 2.3, DOS, this, you know, all of them. And it was like the idea was, I mean, it would be just handy for people developing, you know, the ultimate compatible software.
That'd be very handy. Well,
developers get copies of everything. I mean, if you sign up as a developer and get all their super CDs, you get all this neat stuff, and you can put it on all these different machines.
I used to get that, the MSDN Ultimate subscription, and you get these big notebooks. I mean, it's like 6 feet on the shelf for 1 year's worth of stuff. It's everything. You must get that. I mean, you're developing.
I did for years, but it takes up a lot of the really space does. Over there.
You can download it all now. I think you can get it all online.
Yeah, I sort of stopped doing that. Yeah. And now, as I said, I'm mainly working in Ajax and stuff.
Nielsen reports, oh, get this. This is a little quiz for y'all. Internet TV is growing. It's growing fast. According to Nielsen, which monitors not only regular television viewing, but they do monitor internet use. About 131 million people watch internet video per month. They average about 3 hours. Now, that's a big increase. It was 116 million averaging 2 hours a year ago. They also say about 13 million people watch it on their mobile phone, which is up 52% from last year. And they watch even more. People who watch it on the mobile phone watch 3.5 hours. However, those numbers pale when you compare it to actual television watching. Do you want to guess? Do you gentlemen wish to... Don't, no peeking. Guess how many hours of TV Americans watch on average every month?
I don't know.
Let's see. I would guess a
couple hours a day, right?
I would guess two to three hours a day. So I think you could probably hit 3 times 30, which would be, 100, let's say, 100 hours easy.
153 hours, averaging more than 5 hours a day.
Yeah, that's too much. That's too much watching. It's too much watching TV.
What the hell are they watching?
Well, I don't know. I actually do watch a number of shows religiously. I think The Mentalist is a really good drama. I like, I still watch The Law and Orders. And I watch 30 Rock and maybe one of those. I probably watch.
You're bringing the average up, John.
I'm probably watching 10 hours a week.
Oh.
Which is about 40.
Yeah.
Maybe 40.
How much are people just leaving it on, sort of like while you're doing the dishes, while you're doing other stuff, while you're talking to people?
Well, that's true. I think there's a lot of households which is just on all day. It starts in the morning and just left on all day. 99% of video viewing, 98.8% is television. Only 1.2% is on the internet.
It's a growth market.
Yeah. There. Thank you, John. I was looking for that spin.
That's what it is.
It's growing.
It's like wide open.
Well, unless
there's a trend where it freezes, where in other words, it stops growing, even though I don't see the growth rate going up that fast, obviously from those figures, but it is growing. Well, it's not a dead market.
116 million, 131 million. That's growth in a year.
Yeah. It's something. But what do they mean by video? Are they talking about YouTube? Or are they talking about Hulu?
They're not talking about, Well, I think Hulu is hugely
talking about you.
Successful.
Are they talking about YouTube? Are they talking about Hulu?
They're not talking about me, I can tell you that. But they are talking about Hulu. They are talking about YouTube. And yeah, I mean, I look at my kids. That's what they watch. For them, that's their TV time. If they're going to watch The Office, here's I think what's telling. It doesn't matter to them if it's on TV, if it's on TiVo, or if it's on Hulu. They just watch whatever is convenient. They don't care.
Yeah, and it used to be that the TV that they had was this big 13 or 15 inch TV that they had in their room, or maybe
right.
That used to be a big TV.
Yeah.
And now, you know, you get a laptop and it's going to be 15 inches.
Exactly. It's bigger than your minimum. TV, yeah. Your old TV. When we were kids, why, you were lucky if you had black and white. I actually do.
I had green and white and black for a while.
Yeah. Well, the early color was so bad. I remember very well when I was a kid, my dad refused to buy a color TV. He said, because everybody's green. We had a black and white TV, I think, until the late 60s, maybe even the early 70s. I remember our first color TV was a Sony Trinitron. Boy, that was a big deal. And he was right. You know what? The color was really awful for a long time.
You know, I wonder if the if this viewing thing would be, if the way the numbers are skewed would be affected by things like initiatives like Boxy, which essentially is internet viewing, but on the TV. In fact, and I was looking
that's
at a...
That's the future. I think that's the future.
I was looking at a Sony, by the way, Robert Heron had in the back at ZD he was looking at. And this Sony was one of the... can't remember the model number, but it had internet connections on it and had all these weird things on the side. And you just plug it, basically just plug it into the internet or to an Ethernet cable. And then it had one menu item that brought you to all this online video stuff, including a bunch of packaged stuff. They had Cranky Geeks on the menu.
Really?
Yeah. So I hit the button to watch Cranky Geeks, and I'm watching Cranky Geeks on a 50-inch Sony.
How'd it look?
It looked a lot better than it should. They did a real good job of fixing whatever, kind of it had no artifacting, but it didn't have full 30 frames per second. It seemed to be more like 24 or something. Right. It had just a fair, but it wasn't bothersome. And the mouths were synced.
Wow.
And it was actually watchable as a show.
That's actually very intriguing. Basically, it's an Apple TV built into a Sony TV set kind of thing.
That's what I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Have you taken Hulu and gone, right from your Mac or whatever, right to your big screen TV?
Oh, yeah.
I have friends who do that, and they just sit. They'd rather watch it in HD. It looks pretty good. And we have BIOS in our town.
That's what Boxy did, and Hulu stopped them. Keeps stopping them. Boxy keeps fixing it. But, yeah, that's how I've watched it. It's fine. I mean, it's not... because I'm watching on Wi-Fi. I have a decent cable connection, but, cable internet connection, but... The Wi-Fi, I think, slows it down a little bit. So the frame rate is a little worse. I think kids probably aren't going to have the same sensitivity to frame rate that we will going forward. Yeah. They might just get used to it.
Well, that reminds me of my daughter, who was in the room a second ago, but now she's gone so I can talk about her behind her back. She has like a penchant for... we have this big screen TV up here that has all the HD stuff going into one of the inputs. And then the games and all the other stuff go into another one of the inputs. And when she flips to a game and then flips back to TV, the TV also goes into the... In other words, we have two feeds. And she doesn't care to push it over to the HD feed ever. And she keeps saying that there's no difference. And even though there's a huge difference, because it's, for one thing, the whole screen is filled up instead of, letterboxed, and it's crystal clear, and the other one, she doesn't care.
Wow.
John,
it's baffling. Remember the days of
we worked so hard on letter quality printing. We wanted to get output that looked really, really good, looked as good as a good typewriter, and then people took it and stuck it in the fax, and the fax made it look horrible, and they didn't care. Because they got what they wanted.
Well, and there's a whole generation that's growing up listening to music on crappy MP3 players.
Yep.
They don't know
right,
any
better. Right, and they don't care. When you talk to them about getting a big speaker system that makes it sound like you're in the place, who cares? I'm reminded, we had, when I was doing Silicon Spin once, we had Todd Rundgren on the show. And we got into a discussion about hi-fi, super hi-fi and some of the new stuff coming out. And he made the comment that he didn't think it was important in the least You know, people don't care that much about the sound.
Really?
And I, you know, there's just a group of people.
He was right.
That, yeah, apparently.
He was right.
People don't even, you know, they use these earbuds.
Yeah.
And it's just decimated the old stereo, the hi-fi business. We're used to, you know, get a receiver and a bunch of big speakers and, you know, a big subwoofer and you, you know, shake the house.
I've really forgotten how, you know, you used to be able to really have great stereo sound, and the music would move you. It'd be incredible. You forget about that. It all sounds kind of cheesy and tinny now, and that's just what we're used to.
Yeah. Well, just think what happened with the telephone. We went from telephones wired and they're supposed to be so good and whatever, and then we went to these cell phones that are very unreliable.
Don't get me started.
Right. Okay.
Then we switched from
now. But listen, we're on Skype. Listen how good it sounds.
Right. And people, when they hear Skype, they go, oh, my God, that's incredible. It's like I'm in the room. So eventually it gets there. You can tell the difference, but most people don't know that they can tell the difference. I mean, the same thing happens with video. As I learn about microphones, you know, a pro, they listen to some of the crap that I do. And then they go, you know, if you use the right mic, you know, won't have the, you know, put pillows all around and stuff like that. And it does make a difference. I remember listening to some of the early podcasts when Dave Weiner would do his podcasts. Some of them he would do like with the mic that's built into the PC.
He'd be off like here.
Right.
Yeah. And he doesn't even sound that good.
Right. And I found out that if I was out there running, you know, I was listening to a podcast while I was running. If I went by traffic, I couldn't understand it.
Right.
But if I had really good sound, it would work in those situations. And I realized, aha, I'm doing my listeners a favor by going to all that trouble, but they won't know it. You know, even if it's really poor, the content does matter. John, I don't know if you remember or Leo, a long time ago, there was an online encyclopedia, not online, it was a CD encyclopedia-like thing. And one of the things it had was video. It was very early video. It was this horrible, crappy little stuff, you know, you could barely see it.
Postage stamp.
Postage stamp. And people laughed about that. And I said, let me show you this one video. It's a video of a giraffe giving birth. So they start watching. And in this horrible little video, you see a giraffe giving birth. And, you know, the giraffe stands up. When it gives birth, it falls down. The afterbirth comes down after and splashes all. And they're fascinated. And they forget that they're looking at that. They get lost in the content.
The content trumps the presentation.
Yes.
I guess that's what's happening. It's just kind of, you know.
Eventually, though, I mean, there's a thing like with the microphones, for example. I mean, people do notice these, you know, Leo and I are using right now, and that we're both using these very nice big diaphragm mics that make you sound very clear, even though it's kind of bassy. And it's people notice that it's a more relaxing sound. It doesn't fatigue you. I mean, there's a thing called listener fatigue, which is something people just don't even want to think about, which is that you use these crappy mics that are poorly balanced, and you start listening to people on these systems, and after a while, it actually tires because the brain has to do so much work to piece the thing together so you can hear, like you're talking about, complaining about the noise and the traffic and then trying to hear somebody talk. And it wears some people out, and I think at some point it damages the quality of the product overall because people just stop listening to it, and they don't know why.
They don't know why, yeah.
It's like fonts, you know, good fonts and why they have serifs and all these other things. There are all these little things that were developed over many years that we didn't realize. But the pros know about it. And as you say, it does help us, which is why I have my expensive mic sitting here.
So what mic are you using?
I'm a pro. It's a SM7B, sure, which I have for a strange reason. I was listening the early podcasts with Adam Curry, and Adam said that's what he was using. And I figure if it's good enough for Adam Curry, it's good enough for me. And he sounded so good, but I didn't realize it was his voice too.
He actually has a crystal clear voice.
Yes. So I have,
you know what he uses now?
What?
He there's a lavalier that he's fallen in love with.
That's the one. That's the one that goes on your lapel.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
please.
And I swear, he's talked about it before. It's not like a secret. And he hangs it. Oh. So it's dangling in front of him. And for some reason, he thinks he sounds so much better on this particular. And there are some good lavaliers. I mean, you have for people out there, we don't want to go too much inside baseball, but Leo, at least at the studio there, has a couple of these things called countrymen.
Yeah, they're great.
Who are, or which is not quite a lavalier, but they do make one. But
it's
some
small
little,
enough. The capsule, it's a condenser, Mike. This, so the difference between what you and I are using.
Bitty thing.
And these is that we're using dynamic microphones that aren't powered. These are powered condenser mics. And they are. It's tiny. This is what the TV preachers use.
Right.
It's really small.
They're very small. And they're first time I used one, which was a couple of years ago, because someone said, no, these are, you won't believe what you sound. They, for some reason, are astonishing.
Yeah. But they have to be close mic'd.
And it keeps, they keep falling off your ear.
Well, you know what they do? These use in Broadway, and they do in the Broadway shows, is they'll use a flesh colored tape and they'll tape it to your cheek. I don't think they sound as good, or we stopped using them. I don't think they sound quite as good. I'll plug it in and I'll switch over to it and you can hear what it sounds like.
I think that's where a lot of our processing power is going to go in the future, to sort of take all the crappy mics and stuff and try to figure out how to make things sound better so that you can walk around like Dave did and end up with sound that sounds like what you're getting right now.
Well, you know, it's about 5 years ago, Texas Instruments, you know, has a digital amplifier that they like to play around with, and it's gone into the market in different forms, and they bought out one of the great digital amp companies, and they've done all these different things, and one of the demos they gave was to, using software, to recreate the exact sound of various expensive speaker systems on on a pair of the cheapest little realistic dogs, you know, they got at Radio Shack. And they did it.
Well, it seems like you could. By the way, I'm now on the country.
Oh, you sound terrible.
Oh, it's awful.
It's because he's over-modulated.
I'll turn it down. How's that? Is that better? It seems like you could, with intelligent DSP technology, probably clean it all up, right? It's just a software issue.
Yeah. I mean, hey, where did that deep voice disappear to?
I know. See, it's much hollower because you don't have that. I'll have to talk like this. You don't have the big diaphragm to resonate.
It doesn't sound bad, though.
No, in fact, if you hadn't heard the PR40 before, you'd say this sounds fine.
Yeah, and the PR40 is a specifically mellow microphone that it's just...
It's made for my voice.
A lot of people have the right voice for it. It's just a great microphone.
Yeah. So, actually, I like Conan O'Brien's quote. He says, television allows you to watch things just as you would on your computer or cell phone, except while seated in a more comfortable chair. It's really just the seating. That's the difference.
I agree.
All right, we're going to come back. More stories. We're talking with Dan Bricklin, the creator of VisiCalc, and a blogger extraordinaire, software guru, who still has his hands in just as many pies. He's not retired.
And of course,
John, and a new book. Thank you. But let's give it a big plug, Bricklin on Technology. It's Wiley & Sons?
Yes.
And it's great. We're going to actually talk about that book in a bit. And John C. Dvorak is also here from Channel Dvorak. But I do want to mention our friends at GoToMyPC. I know you both know Ed Iacobucci, who created Citrix many, many moons ago and really began a journey that GoToMyPC is kind of the culmination of, a journey of remote access. He was very instrumental in the OS2 team. He was at IBM. Really, I think, wrote much of the NT kernel and became an expert on the NT kernel and remote access. And the software that Citrix has created is still used today, licensed by Microsoft. They do remote access better than anybody else. GoToMyPC puts that super high quality, super fast, super secure remote access in your computer. In fact, you can try it right now for 30 days absolutely free. Avoid rush hour traffic heading to work. Avoid going in on the weekends. Anytime, you know, I hear it all the time. I thank my lucky stars. I listen to the radio. And I hear the traffic reporters say, oh, yeah, the Golden Gate Bridge is tied up. Oh, it's a 3-hour commute. And I go, I don't have to do that. I got to go to my PC. I don't have to commute anymore. I don't have to get in the car. I can get to my office just by going online from anywhere, not just home, an internet cafe, a hotel. Save time, save money. It's popping on me. Save time, save money. I have to move it out.
Yeah.
Save stress. GoToMyPC.com. You try it free right now by going to GoToMyPC.com/twit, and you get a 30-day free trial. GoToMyPC.com/twit. Fire it up. You can use any program, access any network resource, any file, check email. Secure There's never been an exploit. Uses industry standard TLS and SSL. The best remote access service out there. I want you to try it free. Go to mypc.com/windows. Give it a try. I know you're going to like it. We use it all the time. In fact, I have 5 accounts now. 5 accounts and counting. All right, I'm going to get rid of this microphone. It's driving me crazy. It's too... I want my bass back.
I wish you could go bing, 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 back and forth and back and forth with it.
To give you an A-B comparison?
Yeah.
Yeah, I need a switch or something. I could probably do that. I would just have to... see, isn't that much better? That's nicer.
Yeah, it's because there's a lower mid-range that exists in the PR40. The 40 that is very noticeable.
And you know that I think that lower mid-range is critical for that's the pitch that you use to understand speech. So if it's got a little bump there, I think it makes it more intelligible. I don't know. But that's where Adam Curry's voice is perfect because it's got that it's almost an edge, I call it, but it gives it that if it's too you can't understand it. You need a little edge in there to understand the articulation.
Yeah, but you still have to enunciate.
He enunciates very well. He's also got beautiful hair.
You know, you've got good hair for a guy your age.
For an old guy. I'm thinking Dan looks pretty good. Look at that.
Thanks. Nice. Well, I'm the oldest of the three of us, so by just a little bit.
I think we're roughly the same generation.
Oh, yeah.
There are some, actually, you know, now that I look at it, there's some very interesting stories this week. For instance, the OQO is gone. That's kind of sad, but I guess inevitable.
From day one.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, the fact that they lasted 7 years.
It's a miracle.
It's almost kind of amazing.
Yeah. When I read that, I was running around looking for my old pocket, you know, the old pocket.
Oh, yeah. Pocket. Yeah.
Pocket. Yeah, I couldn't find it. It's back in the warehouse.
I have it. I have mine.
You do?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I have two interesting ones. I got a Pocket, and I also have that little Radio Shack piece of crap that they
Tandy
came out
Model
with.
Model 100?
No. They came out with a Pocket clone.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That was it used an operating system called iDot or something. Oh. It was a clone of Microsoft. And that's floating around. But the Pocket, I think,
Atari?
Is collectible.
There was an Atari.
Oh, maybe that's what it was. I'm sorry. You're right. That's what it was.
I have
it was
both of those, too. But the they're Atari. In a box away in the warehouse.
So this just proves that these little teeny-weeny computers are fetish objects for geeks.
No.
Yeah, they collect them. They can't do
yes.
We just have two geeks that collected those two items.
No, I think it's not. I think it's universal.
I don't have the Tandy 100. That I would have collected.
You can buy those still on eBay. I mean, those are at a premium, I might add.
Hmm.
Those are still beloved by journalists everywhere. That was, there was a time if you went to a baseball game, every single person in the press box was using a Model 100.
Yeah. And that was the last machine that Bill Gates actually did real live code for that was, you know, not just a little game or something.
What did he do on that?
I don't know. He did something in it, but if you talk to him about coding, I think he wrote one of the games that was shipped with the IBM PC or something in BASIC, one of the sample games. But, you know, the last production real life code, I think it was the 100, he says, and he waxes poetic. I mean, you can see his eyes go, that was the last real code that I got to ship. Maybe now that he's out of Microsoft, he's getting to write some real code for fun.
Oh, please.
Oh, if you're a coder, it's so much fun. I mean, that's why I'm doing that.
He doesn't have enough time in the day. I wish he would go write some code. How about some code to fix Vista?
It's called Windows 7.
Yeah, I guess
he's out of Microsoft. He can write stuff in whatever he wants, and for purposes like to help fight malaria or something while he's flying over there.
Do you think he might do that?
I don't know.
That'd be very cool.
Yeah, I mean,
be brutally frank. Don't you find that your brain just doesn't have the capacity to focus and retain all the loose threads and stuff that it did when you were a younger guy?
I don't know. I'm able to do some stuff that I'm still pretty proud of. I mean, I look back at some old code I've written and I go, who wrote that? That was incredible. And I was like, I wrote that. How did I do that? I look at other stuff and said, what horrible person wrote that? Oh, my God, it's me. Sometimes, I mean, if you have to be able to get into it, I mean, it still takes sometimes, the 10 hours straight to be able to do the one little piece of code or something and do it for days.
Yes. So, Steve Gibson, who's also our age, is working on a new project And he goes to Starbucks, gets there about 5:30 when they open, and stays till 7 or 8 at night. He stays 12 hours nonstop assembly language programming. Mm. And I think that's it. You have to kind of get in a zone, don't you?
Yeah. And you have to get into your tools. It takes a while to get into the tool.
Right. Somebody said, I think it was Randall Schwartz, the Perl programmer, said, if I don't program in Perl 3 hours a day, I lose it. That's Perl. That's Perl.
That's Perl. I program in Perl too, and but I program in Perl that looks more like Visual Basic, and not more like APL, like a lot of people do.
Perl is one of those tools. If you don't use it regularly, you completely forget the syntax.
Oh yeah,
but there are some languages that aren't like that.
Well, there's programs like that. I mean, Adobe Illustrator is a good example.
Yeah, Bezier curves. What are those? So OQO. I guess it was 2002. I remember showing it on Regis and Kelly right around 2002. You know why they finally just what was it that finally put the nail in the coffin on this thing? I'm back through an article on this thing. We are sad to report that due to
nobody wanted to buy any of them. Maybe they think that
financial constraints. They're saying we are not able to offer repair and service support at this time. We are deeply sorry that despite our best intentions, we are unable to provide continued support for our faithful customer. That's sad.
Faithful customer? Is that what you said?
Yeah, I forgot to pluralize it. There were two of them.
Yeah, well, you have to try. I mean, we did all that software for these old pen computers for Go and all.
Slate,
Right, and we wrote this really cool software and stuff, but nobody bought the machines. So we sold like two copies of some of the software.
But it was just ahead of its time.
I always referred to them as Go Broke.
Yeah. Well, they kept changing the spec on the software, on the hardware.
Oh.
So you had to change your hardware. So first we wrote to a 286. Then you had to rewrite the whole thing for the 386. Then they changed to the Hobbit chip. And each time before you could ship, you had to recode everything. So, you know, plus people really didn't want a computer that was based upon handwriting and stuff. They like touch type of stuff. And they couldn't do color. The digitizers didn't do well with color.
Right.
And the contrast sucked.
Oh, yeah. Right. You couldn't read it. The grid, was the grid the same kind of?
Yeah, the grid pad. Grid convertible was a good machine.
Yeah.
The grid convertible was a good machine. But the thing is that they couldn't do digitizers well through, except for, I guess, the Wacom or something, which was expensive.
But did they have to have
color displays?
They'd have to have layers, and they have to have a capacitance layer and all that stuff. And it would just get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. By the time you were seeing through all these layers, it was like through a cloud. You know?
Now, isn't there an item floating around the news, a gossip item, that Apple will be doing a pad computer?
Oh, yeah. Yes. The rumors are strong. Although the question is time frame, some think maybe they'll announce it June 8th at the developers conference, which is coming up. That seems unlikely. Others now the latest rumor is it'll be next year. Yeah. But they bought according to I think it was EE Times, one of these Chinese electronics.
EE Times is Palo Alto Menlo Park.
Maybe it's not that one. They bought a bunch of 10.5-inch touchscreens.
Yeah. Well, if you use a netbook a lot, you realize that it's a really good idea to make a tablet of the type that they're talking about.
I agree.
Because netbooks, the problem is they're horizontal and you like to read and they have small screens. So you really want to turn it sidewards and the keyboard's sticking out. And for a lot of stuff, we don't need keyboard if we have touch.
Right.
And so it looks like it might be the time for it finally. We'll see. But it's good that these people tried. I mean, the fact that that old little Windows machine, you know, they tried and tried for a few years and just turned out that Windows wasn't right for a little machine when you could have a bigger machine.
It ran, I remember the first ones ran XP and then it ran Vista and it was so tiny. You had a little stylus. It was just, it was teensy and you could barely, I don't know what the dot pitch was.
I know the one you're showing there is like huge by comparison to the original.
Yeah.
The original had like little bitty keys and it was super miniature.
Now, suppose it had a user interface that was kind of like Android.
Yeah.
That would have been a lot different.
You know, Intel announced this week a mini operating system for netbooks called Moblin. It's an open source project based on Linux. I downloaded and installed it on my Wind and immediately took it off. Immediately. They keep trying to do this. You know, and I think Android might be a little bit like that, where it's a little stripped down and I could see the motivation for the OQO. You kind of want a full operating system, but the problems to solve you know, are pretty significant to get a full operating system on something that size.
Yeah. Well, at least we've learned with the iPod and the iPod Touch and all that there's a subset and a different set of applications that are worthwhile having in a portable environment. And because everything's wired, you can do things that are dependent on being wired, I mean, or wireless. You can be connected and you can do reading and things that you used to be able to do. You know, the Kindle has been relatively successful.
Love with, the Kindle.
Right. And it's it barely does anything, but it does at least one thing very well. So you can see that that form factor might be okay because now there are enough useful things we can do with it that you don't need to bring your laptop, your full set of applications with you. You don't have to run Photoshop on it. You don't have to run full Word on it or things like that.
Yeah. Hey, Dan, do you use a iPhone or an Android and why?
Yeah, I use Android.
Huh. Not surprised. I would have picked that.
Yeah. But I have an iPod Touch that I used to learn about the interface and stuff like that. And I'll probably get a Pre.
I'm excited about the Pre. The more I see about the Pre, they just Engadget has a leaked pre-launch manual for the Pre for Business.
I think your Pre excitement is premature.
I think it's going to be pretty good, but I think I have to pre-order the Pre. It's a pre-order.
There's an interesting thing about the Pre that the programming is done in systems that people are already used to.
Yeah, you like Ajax. This is Ajax, essentially.
A lot of people know how to program in JavaScript and CSS and stuff like that, rather than having to learn Java or use a Java system or you know, Objective-C or something like that.
Is there support, Dan, do you know, for things like jQuery for some of the JavaScript libraries?
I don't know. I haven't played with it yet, so I'll find out.
Do you use jQuery for your stuff?
No. The people I work with at SocialText use it a lot. It's been really helpful for them.
Yeah.
But for my stuff, I've written it to run on its own so that I have a pretty clean system. And the early versions of jQuery that I had were slowed things down a little bit and affected the recalc that I was doing with my SocialCalc software for the spreadsheet. And I wanted it to run on really small systems like the one laptop, which it's running on now.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
neat. Apparently, there are people in Nepal and in Colombia who are using my open source spreadsheet written in JavaScript to do real work.
So tell us about that. I didn't know you'd done that. You wrote a spreadsheet in JavaScript.
What I did was, originally I had written a spreadsheet in Perl that used a little bit of JavaScript and ran, it was called WikiCalc, and it's open source GPL that I released out there, and it used the browser somewhat, but it was kind of clunky. And I started working with the guys at SocialText that have a commercial wiki. And so when trying to figure out how to do it right, I realized I really had to move the whole spreadsheet client side. So I've re-implemented the whole thing as a JavaScript spreadsheet that lets you, you can, you know, scroll around, you can have split planes. It does a lot of the stuff that while you're editing is like what you can do with Google spreadsheets and came out around the same time. But it doesn't need a back end to do the calculations and all. And it handles very large spreadsheets compared to, I mean, it'll handle 1,000 or more rows, 2,000 rows of data.
Wow.
And people, I think, have already incorporated into Drupal. And SocialText has been talking about it, and they have it in limited beta to some of their customers. And we'll see what will happen over the next few months.
Compare it in power to VisiCalc.
Oh, it's like no comparison. It's much more powerful than VisiCalc. It's, you know, it does a lot of the display that Excel did, let's say, back in Excel 97. You know, you can do the different colors and formats and...
Not pivot tables, nothing like that.
No, it doesn't have pivot tables. Not yet. It doesn't have pivot tables.
That's okay, because I still don't understand pivot tables.
So right, yes. But it, you know, it has like 100 different functions and, you know, internal rate of return and all that stuff. And it takes advantage of the browser in many ways. And now you can even cut and paste from Excel, and it feels like a spreadsheet. And the guys at SocialText are working to make it fit in really well with their commercial level wiki system, so that you can use all the, you can calculate something that uses a sheet that's another page, that's another page, that's another page, and does all the right roll-ups for you.
That's great.
You have a URL that people can go check it out?
Not yet. Wait and see what Social Text does.
If you go to socialtext.net, you can actually find.
.com. Yeah, they talk about it, but you can't try it yet. You can actually download the One Laptop version, and in fact, I think it's on a lot of the One Laptops, and run it on your One Laptop. I think the version that I have listed under on softwaregarden.com about SocialCalc, I think you can download and play with it. That's a much older version.
I'm seeing 1.1.0 at socialcalc.org.
Nah, that's a whole other thing.
That's not it, huh?
That was a Perl.
That's the Perl version. Yeah.
Forget about that, and you won't be able. I think it's not even there if you click on it.
Oh, you're
so
right.
You can download WikiCalc and play with it.
That's even older, right? That predates that. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait a little while. I'll be posting some stuff. I've just finished doing a lot of updates to it. Now, when I do my recalc, I have a little timer loop, and it lets you have very long recalculation. You get progress bars underneath and stuff. And it can go out and ask for another sheet and another sheet and another sheet as it's rolling up in a big calculation.
Where do you stand on the idea of software as a service or cloud computing? I don't.
They're different.
they're different, but it's not clear. Okay. So first of all, tell me the difference.
Well, the way I see it, I mean, I've been learning about this by listening to, you know, others talk about some of it and reading some books. I think Amy Wall has a book about software as a service that's pretty good that she publishes herself on Lulu. And software as a service, yeah, it's like time sharing used to be. It's we provide applications that actually run that you get, you know, through your browser or something of that sort. And of course, with AIR and Silverlight and stuff, we're able to do some pretty incredible applications. JavaScript has just jumped everything up, you know, in terms of what we've been able to do. But then we have Adobe Air, et cetera. So, but if you have a full application, that's what I would call software as a service when you're getting it over the browser. Cloud computing is, you go down a level. It's where there's a lot of the parts of running and the back end are available as a service. So, for example, Amazon gives you the ability to have storage as a service that you can take advantage of. And other places, let's say like SmugMug, use their back end that's provided in the internet for storage.
They actually use Amazon, I think.
They actually use Amazon, yeah. Right. They use S3. They use the Amazon storage. SmugMug uses that, which is taking advantage of cloud computing. So, but cloud computing has different things that could be available on demand in the cloud that you can just get when you need it, that it's not yours. You're using it as a service, but it's usually a service in service of the thing that you're doing. So Amazon also provides you just plain CPUs running an operating system like Linux. Right. So you can have web browsers and you can fire them up just by saying, give me one. It's not yours. You're just using it as a service. And then there are other services you could provide like, credit card services, and I think Google's starting to provide a variety of services in the back end. And would you view Google Maps taking advantage of some of the things Google Maps does? Is that software as a service, or is that cloud computing where they provide you something?
Yeah, that's where the confusion lies. The line is blurred for sure.
I was just recently in Holland and went to a meeting of the cloud computing folks they had this club, a SIG. And their argument that they're using now, I think Dan touches on it, but it boils down to kind of the following, as one guy told me. He says, there's a lot of big companies that are getting sick and tired of their IT department.
Yes.
Period.
Yes.
And they just want to get them, they just want to fire them all, but they can't quite do that. But what they can do is move to the cloud and let these, you know, like a professional IT department that is not so meddlesome, run the back end of their operation. And that's a sad
statement.
Or one piece of the operation. It's a piece you may not want to be the person who takes care of the storage.
Right.
You know, and you don't want to buy racks of storage. You don't know how much you're going to need. And you may have where temporarily you need a lot. And then for a while, you know, let's say around Christmas time, you need an awful lot for some reason. And then, you know, after the big buying season, you don't need it. Why buy all that stuff when you can sort of rent it from Amazon or somebody else?
So you're bullish on cloud computing slash
software as a service.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, it's time sharing. It's like, I mean, this stuff is.
Well, I mean, that's the. I think that's John's objection to it is that it's time sharing.
So,
that yeah, my well, so is a big is kind of a bigoted thing to say. I think the thing is what I complain about is not so much software as a service or cloud computing for a large corporation that wants to outsource its IT department because it just can't take it anymore. I'm just complaining about the individual who starts to rely too much on offsite mechanical, you know, or offsite software, or offsite storage. When you can buy a terabyte drive at Costco for $89, and you got plenty of storage, you don't need to put your photos online. I mean, a lot of people have put their photos, and I have no objection to SmugMug and all these companies.
I keep a local copy, but I put it on SmugMug.
Yeah, a lot of people use these different systems, and it's fine. It's one way of distributing at least thumbnails. I mean, but you know, nowadays
I put the raw files up there on their.
It's just how long does it take? Well, you're sitting. Okay, you're sitting on. Let's remind people.
I'm
you're
sitting on a lot of bandwidth
on a 10 megabit per second.
I don't use that though for the uploading. I mean, I don't this stuff. I mean, it takes a while, but I do it at home.
I have five. I mean, because I have FiOS here. I mean, we're going to have it like that.
Yes.
The thing is, John, I think I agree. You should keep your own copy. It is so cheap to be able to do that, but it's also good to be able to have it up there. But a lot of this, if you think of from a company viewpoint, where they do have needs to change, being able to take advantage of more than you have whenever you want extra to have that extra stuff. Being able to get it out in the cloud is a nice thing.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to argue that.
Well, I'll give you an example.
The fact that it's nice to have offsite storage in case your house burns down.
But it's not relying on the cloud. It's a secondary.
Right, that's what I object to.
Yeah.
Yes, I think you're right because I mean we see all the problems when these things go down. You really need a way to not have a single point of failure.
Yeah, I'll give you an example because my kids' high school. I was talking to them about technology. And it's a very expensive thing for a school to invest in hardware and software. It gets obsolete much more quickly than they'd like it to be. It adds up. Whereas they could do a lot of this stuff instead of buying Microsoft Office, they could use Google Docs or Zoho Office. What's wrong with that? Yeah. I mean, isn't that a better way to go?
For some things, sometimes. Yeah. I mean, there are times when it's right. There's a time for this and a time for that. Okay. A time for this, you know. And John's right. There's sometimes when it's wrong and... sometimes it's right. And the trick is knowing when to use the right thing. And things change over time. Something that used to be right may be wrong. And I mean, that's one of the things to get into my book. Things evolve. And I think people have to understand how a lot of this stuff evolves over time. Ideas that were bad ideas in the old days may be good today and vice versa.
I mean, how many of us rely on Gmail these days? That's cloud computing.
Yeah,
I want to actually get back, circle back around to the pre with you, Dan, in just a bit and talk a little bit about that. But I want to also take a break right now. So, John, if you want to baste your meat, go right ahead.
I'm going to go baste.
Well, we do this on Sunday afternoon and John often is cooking. I guess he gets the cooking detail on Sunday. If you want to go baste your meat, you may as well. But I want to mention Audible.com. Audible is our great sponsor. We love Audible. We love audiobooks. I'm a big audiobook fanatic. I live on Audible.com. Audible is basically your online library. You download the book. Comes, by the way, you know, in seconds. It does not take long. A couple of minutes and you've got an entire novel or history or great sci-fi novels. And they're all available to you. You browse, you pick. I want to recommend the Audible Platinum account today, audible.com/twit2, because with audible.com/twit2, you get two books for free. Sign up today, and you get two credits towards your own books. You get to keep them even if you decide not to stick around. But let me tell you, you might have a little bit of difficulty choosing. There's so many good ones. Dan, I don't think your book is on audio, unfortunately.
But. No, not yet, but... at this point, I would rather it maybe be on audio before it would be on the Kindle.
Really? Why is that?
Well, one of the things about audio is that you have all that ability in your voice to do what you do in typography on the page.
That's true. It's expressive.
And right. And the Kindle has very limited typography initially, especially when you move a book automatically over to it. When they first tried moving my book over, it lost a lot and had a lot of errors. We had to nix it. But if you had somebody reading it with a good voice, who'd be able to let you know when it was a quote and use different voices in place of typography, you have a lot more freedom.
Very interesting. I never thought of that, but you're absolutely right. And the readers they use are the best. I mean, these guys are so good. I'm going to recommend a book that's a classic. In fact, many have said, you know, one of the most influential books of all time. Times Literary Supplement said it's one of the 100 most influential books since the Second World War. It's Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. We know you twit listeners are smart people. This is a great choice for somebody who wants to read a classic. Unabridged, read by Dennis Holland, and just in a stunning rendition. Let me play a little bit of this for you, just to give you an idea of what it might sound like.
Those conceptions were ones I had previously drawn, partly from scientific training itself, and partly from a long-standing avocational interest in the philosophy of science.
You can hear the typography, by the way. Mm-hmm. You can hear because he's speaking as the writer. This is a landmark in intellectual history, a classic. Now, that's just one. You get another one. So I'm sure you'll find from our many recommendations, you're going to find a second book you want. This is, I have to say, Audible is, to me, it's like going back to school. It's like being entertained. It's like watching great movies. It's all of the above. I want you to try it out for free. Go to audible.com/twit2. Your first month's free includes two free books. And Thomas Kuhn's classic, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, would be a great one to start with. He was from MIT professor, really talks about these paradigm shifts that change everything. We're in the middle of them. I mean, we see them happening almost, you know, yearly in this business. This book is, you know, when was this written? I think it was written, I don't know, the 60s, I think.
It's a very popular book amongst the kids nowadays in college.
Is it really?
It's big time. My son is the one who turned me on to it.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, it's really good. I'm trying to remember where I got turned up. Probably somebody sent it in an email. I get a lot. It's really fun now. I get a lot of recommendations for audio books from Audible from our listeners. The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, it's big with the kids. Thomas Kuhn, 1962. Thank you. That's when it was written. Audible.com/twit2. We thank them so much for their support. You know, they've been asking me at Audible what book I want to read. They said, we want you to read a book. Maybe it'll be Bricklin on Technology. I'll channel you. Actually, Dan, you should read it.
In fact, I just put up a little YouTube video this afternoon where I read a little bit of the first chapter.
Oh, good.
And a little bit of another chapter, yeah.
That's a great idea.
But I'm not a professional reader, so.
Neil Gaiman did that.
You can read.
Oh, yeah, you sound great. You got the Shure mic. Neil Gaiman did that with his most recent book. He YouTubed. It was actually really cool. He videoed his book appearances, and in each appearance, he'd read a different chapter. So eventually, he got the whole thing, and he put it up on YouTube.
What a great idea.
Isn't that great?
Cool. It's a great idea.
And I don't think that slows sales.
And I'd like to read an excerpt.
Chapter one. Well, it was a juvenile, so it wasn't that long. But, I mean, that doesn't reduce sales. That just improves sales, if you ask me. And Neil is a very...
No, there's actually a lot of studies that indicate that's the case.
Neil's a great reader, too. He does.
I'm going to start reading and putting up on YouTube a reasonable amount of it. We'll see if I get some good feedback on it. I have a section I know, whatever people tell me in an interview or something that they liked a section, then I know maybe that's the one I should read and put up, and
that's a good
I'll
idea.
Do some of those.
That's a good
so
idea.
So if there's anything you like, John, let me know, and I'll read it.
What I'd like is the book was very enjoyable, but it didn't have to, in my opinion, enough dirt.
Where's the gossip, Dan?
Yeah. Well, there's stories to be told about, and... You know, in the early day, in fact, I was chronicling it as it occurred. And then later, I kind of deconstructed the whole event, talking to Dan and Bob and also
Bob Frankston, who also
Bob Frankston and Feilstra. And then there's the fourth guy who I actually have never managed to run into.
What, Peter Jennings?
Yeah, Jennings. I don't think I've ever met him. Oh, I might have.
These are the four horsemen of VisiCalc.
Yeah, and there was a, it was an interesting, it was one of the early kind of blow-ups that took place in the industry. I mean, there's been other examples, but the industry was shaky, and it was easy for things to blow up because these guys were, like you said, this was the first killer app ever, and it actually triggered the revolution, the desktop computing revolution in many ways. It would have not taken the same direction had this product not appeared. And so these guys were on new, they're kind of in a new space, and it was an interesting, it had an interesting effect on the various egos. And it resulted in a very, unfortunately, collapse of the of the company, the marketing group, and everybody in between. Because anyway, the story's never been adequately.
Oh, yeah, it's lawsuit city. I mean, it was. Now, as I point out in the book, I say, hey, there are some pretty bad times, but the book is not a business book; it's a technology book, and that's a business story. And it's a story that will hopefully be told one of these days, and I would have need help from the others involved. And there was one time when a lot of us came together for a history meeting of sorts, and it was all recorded where we talked about some of those things. And if you follow the links that my book points to, you'll eventually get to what Ed Esber has to say and what Feilstra has to say and whatever about different things. But we had an author-publisher relationship, and an author-publisher relationship is not a good thing when you have a hit. You know, in a hit business, that's not really a good thing. And that's how things were structured in those days. Others learned from that, that that's not what you should do, which is why Ashton Tate ended up buying out Wayne Ratliff before they could go public, or I think maybe around the time, whatever. So they didn't have that author-publisher relationship, which is an unstable relationship. And there were a lot of personalities involved, a lot of things. And my book is about, you know, technology evolving. And the VisiCalc story I wanted to tell was about how it was developed and how it got out there, not the part about how it fell apart, because that would have been another 500 pages. And I have material. One of these days, maybe Bob and I will get together. Maybe we get you to talk about what you saw outside, because you were commenting around then. There was a lot of intrigue. We haven't even talked about half of what went on.
Yeah, but, no, that's my understanding. There's still a lot and a lot of still, then some ill feelings still kind of just residual. I don't think anybody cares anymore that much, but it's just one of those things.
Well, less so. I mean, Feilstra and I actually, you know, we get along relatively well when we see each other. And, wanted a copy. I offered him a copy of the book, which he readily accepted a copy of. And he's been very nice about that stuff. And I sent him as a courtesy what I wrote, whatever I would mention him in advance. In fact, I did that for around 50 people who I quote in the book in some way. I got permission from them whether or not I needed it. So
that's fact checking usually accounts for that, which is a good practice if you have the time.
Yeah, well, it was also, some of them I had to get written permission from, because I use a lot of other people's material in the book, because I try to be like a blog and a website where you have this back and forth with others. And when you're reading a book, you don't have the other side. You can't just click on a link in the book. So, and a lot of the links don't work anymore. I had to go to archive.org to find a lot of the material. Mm. So I got stuff from Evan Williams. I got stuff from Dave Weiner, Clay Shirky. I mean, all these different people gave me stuff, and I got permission to put it in there.
That sounds exciting.
So how did you publish it? Who published the book, and what kind of, you made a deal with, what was it again?
It's Wiley. Wiley approached
Wiley,
me.
Wiley.
Yeah, they approached me and said, hey, you've got it all written. You know, it's just take stuff on your blog and maybe write a few new things, and you'll be done.
And we'll give you 5%.
Like, yeah, and... So I finally accepted. I said, okay, I'll write a lot of stuff. I have to write new stuff. I have to put things around it. It isn't actually the order of the blog. It's basically I'm talking about different themes that I've been talking about over the years. And where appropriate, I brought something in from my website. And where not appropriate, I'll write something new.
Yeah, the chronology resets quite a bit, which is fine, because I think it gives people, it makes the book easier to read.
Yeah, and that's one of the typography things I had to deal with, is how do I let you know that you're reading something 5 or 6 pages long that's something from, you know, back in 1999, that if I talk about, Napster still was around, or cell phones weren't as ubiquitous as they are now, et cetera, et cetera. So I worked on that real hard. And actually, if you go to my website, I wrote a whole piece about what I went through figuring out how to do the layout and how to write this book and how to put it together. It was a lot of work. But for people who blog, I think they'll learn something from it about how they can take their blog maybe and turn it into a book if they want to.
I love it that you have in your blog a little snippet from the business school paper you wrote that, you know, kind of inspired VisiCalc.
Yeah, that was about VisiCalc. I mean, I was working on it, and I had this paper I was writing that wasn't going to be published. And they said, write something on an advertising situation. So I'll write about advertising this new product that wasn't called VisiCalc.
It was called Calculedger, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And the last line in it is the funniest. I mean, I was thinking of calling it electronic spreadsheet, but I said that most people don't know what a spreadsheet is. More people know what a ledger is. So, you know.
It's good it you was, didn't call it Calculedger. I
yeah,
just
Calculedger is bad.
I know. Well, Dan Feilster made the decision to use the name VisiCalc.
Yeah, no, I think that's a...
Yeah, they both think that they came up with the name, and we have whole stories about that. But Feilstra said, hey, this is the name. We had all these meetings. We'd get together. What name? We had 50 different names. And finally, he said, okay, we're going to go with VisiCalc. That's it. And it was a good name. Though it could have been Excel or 1-2. It could have been 1, you know.
Lotus 1.
Or Lotus 1. So what were you, how involved were you in the decision and the initiative to do Vision?
Not at all. Well, that's getting into the sore points. They decided to do, the people who published VisiCalc, the company that named it, started out as personal software, renamed itself as VisiCorp.
By the way, that's another, you have to be careful. I always tell people, you know, in fact, I hope that some people run these names by me, because any writer worth his salt immediately takes, and I think I wrote this in InfoWorld, takes a name like that and you immediately call it VisiCorpse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And, you know,
you can't resist. I mean, come on. It's like the pre-mature and the pre-bankruptcy and the, you know, the go broke and the rest of them. I mean, you have to use that material.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like I don't call it a Trash 80. It was the TRS-80. It was a machine that was really helpful for a lot of people. But the company VisiCorp decided that, I guess maybe they had seen people who knew what was going on at Xerox PARC. And they decided that they wanted to do something that was mouse-based and graphics-based. And they did this whole system, which, you know, from my visual, when I saw it, you know, it took all the disadvantages of character-based with all the disadvantages of graphics-based for that day. But it was a windowing system that ran on top of DOS. And it used a mouse, and it was really cool. And they developed some cool stuff. Unfortunately, they decided that they wanted to find maybe their spreadsheet they wrote themselves, even though our contract said that they were supposed to pay us if they had a spreadsheet. We sort of had a back and forth, you know, tight contract between us. So there were business problems, and we ended up in a lawsuit. With them, they had, unfortunately, their product was underpowered or it took too much power on the PCs of the day. And when it came out, it didn't sell very well. I have a copy sitting back there under the eaves that I picked up at a garage sale or something.
Well, and you must have. I actually think I have the original copies. Didn't they sell this to Control Data or something?
Eventually,
screwy?
Yeah. They had to raise some money at all. After they tried suing us, and then they lost that lawsuit, and there was all sorts of stuff. They were bleeding money, and all sorts of stuff went on, which I'm not sure of what happened. I wasn't there. But I think they ended up selling some rights to Control Data, but nothing much happened of it. But it helped spur Microsoft on with Windows to get Windows yep. out there. And but Windows, notice, took many tries, a long time, many years to get going. VisiCorp, unfortunately, didn't have the runway that Microsoft had. And 123 was hurting them with VisiCalc. They sued us, which cost a lot of money in terms of stuff. And all that went away, and they weren't able to survive with that. If they had had the cash cow that Microsoft had to keep them going, I'm sure they would have eventually made Visio on something really cool. They had some really good people working on it, is what I was told. I never, you know, got to work much with it. Mm. We were at that time not on such great terms talking with them.
This era from about 1979 to about 1985 or so, it's still somewhat foggy in a lot of kind of areas. And it's never been really the history of the industry's kind of beats around the bush about a lot of stuff that went on. I mean, because there's mainly because the period was so rich with stuff.
So much going on. You couldn't keep track of
that. Some of the really probably some of the more interesting stories have yet to be told.
Yeah, I hope somebody does it.
I hope we get that stuff because it is really valuable from a historic viewpoint and the software industry part and the hardware business. The hardware, more of it's been, been documented. But, you know, I try at least to provide whatever documents I have, start putting them up. Like you'll notice in the book, I put a lot of pictures of stuff that are in my notebook because I took notes about when we did things. So I know on that day I found out about Control-Alt-Del, you know, I found out on that day that that's what happened. That's when IBM came to us. And that's why I put my paper up when I saw that paper. I said, hey, let's share this. I have an old video I'm going to put up when I get to get it in the right form to put up on YouTube, where I took a home video system, you know, with those things you carry on your shoulder and a big box on the side.
Yeah.
In 1983, one of my employees, Cheryl, and I walked around Condex, and for an hour and a half, we took pictures. I have a demonstration of Windows pre-Windows 1 when it's being demonstrated, where they explain, you know, about the different panes. Remember that stuff?
Right, and the clock.
Yes, the clock. And you get to see it, you know. And I had the IBM demonstrating in a demonstration room with many of them, the PC Junior. And they, wow. You know, now don't touch it yet. Okay, now you can turn it on, you know, and push the this button. And it's really funny to see that, how we were going gaga over these machines that were character-based. And Apple was showing, now this is 83, before the Mac, and they were showing what looked like Mac Paint with a mouse running on the Apple II.
Oh, wow.
Found that sort of buried in there. I found Bill Gates talking with John Sachs. Now, John Sachs is the guy who wrote 1-2-3.
Right.
And Bill Gates was talking with him. And
he's doing Picture It or something now.
Well, yeah, in Triumph of the Nerds, a few seconds of that video was used, but I didn't give them permission to use the sound because I didn't have permission from Bill. But I think now would be okay to put it up. Bill talks about how they use Xenix to do all their development. It's really funny. He's, you know, yeah, we use, you know, basically they're using Unix to do development at Microsoft. And he's talking with the guy who did 1-2-3.
At least it was a Microsoft product.
Yeah, yeah, it was their version of.
Yeah, you think you'd put that on YouTube? You put it on your blog? Yeah. That'd be great to see.
I would put it up. It's too long to put on YouTube. I'd put it up on Google Video.
Well, big is it? Because you know they've changed their. You can put up a gigabyte now. Oh, yeah,
hour.
You might be able to talk.
You can
to
get permission. In fact, I can hook you up. We were just talking with Kevin Marks from Google about that yesterday because we want to start putting full length podcasts up on YouTube, and he said no. For somebody who's a producer, we know you're not going to be putting, you know, copyright material up. We can arrange that. So
yeah, no, this one, the problem was that the DVD I had with it doesn't read into my video program without, you know, breaking up right.
So hey, at least you had a DVD. You don't have to.
Well, no, that's the DVDs from the tape, which I stuck in my little machine downstairs that converts tapes to DVDs and stuff. I did put up a video of Go Corporation of Robert Carr demonstrating PenPoint.
Wow.
That's up on Google Video, and it's like an hour demo, and he demonstrates all the stuff about that.
Yeah, it's great that there's stuff like Google Video on YouTube now. I mean, you can see, Doug Engelbart's very famous, you know, park demonstration, whatever it was, 64 or 62, and all that video, the entire video is there, and people can see it. If somebody has the interest in this stuff, this material at least is still...
It's good to have archives of that
Thank
stuff.
Goodness.
And it's not chewing up a lot of bandwidth, because it's not like everybody, you know, a million people want to watch it.
Well, it's historic. You know, one of the things I really am sad about with Tech TV and wanted to do with Tech TV is kind of document all this stuff. I don't, you know, they apparently, John and I have this battle, but apparently they have saved everything. So,
oh, well, maybe one of these days.
There's
you know,
no way.
They swear to me, somebody. John. In fact, they've been digitizing it and they're going to put it all online. I talked to them.
They have one or two things, but
they
I guarantee
they
have
everything. They have everything.
How can they say that when I have the Silicon Spin tapes in my basement?
There were copies made.
Oh, why would they do that?
I don't know. They say they have everything. We'll see. But they're digitizing it.
So, by the way, I just want to just interrupt for 1 second.
Yeah.
Jonathan Sachs has a company called Digital Light and Color. I think he needs a plug. He has a product called Picture Window and it's Picture Window Pro 5.0. You can go to dl-c.com for Digital Light and Color. And it's a very interesting photo editor that does some things that none of the other editors do, including some geometric stuff, which is very valuable to people who have perspective control problems with some of their photos. Anyway, just give him. I've always wanted to look at this product.
He was using it for if you take pictures of the sky and you know the aberrations in your telescope, you could use it to make more exact versions. I think that was great. One of the initial uses for that. Wow.
Yeah, and he's a coded Lotus 1-2-3 in assembler,
That did a kind of wonderful job. Nobody was able to knock off his code in that on that machine. It was an incredible code base what he did.
Yeah, he's
John
a good
did
guy.
A great job. Yeah, he really is. I actually knew him before we did VisiCalc. But
should have hired him.
In fact, I hired the guy who worked with him. I hired Ray Ozzie. Who worked with him.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then Ray left to go work over with Mitch over working on Symphony, and then he did notes, etc. Now he's at Microsoft. And he blurbed the cover of my book.
And architecting their cloud computing initiative.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
Ray's, they're real lucky to have him there. And let's hope he's able to do the things that he wants.
Well, Dan, I think we're going to have to get you back on Twit because we've just scratched the surface. There's so much to talk about.
It's lots of fun.
It's really been fun. And what's great is that not only do you have the historic background, but you got your finger on the pulse of what's going on right now. We didn't get back to the pre, but maybe in a few weeks when the pre comes out, I'd love to get your impressions of that as somebody who is a JavaScript programmer. Mm-hmm. You know, Apple, that was Apple's plan with the iPhone was, oh, you don't need to write applications. We'll just support CSS, AppleScript.
Yeah.
JavaScript. That didn't work out so well.
Well, didn't do the good things in JavaScript. You didn't get mouse down and mouse
right.
move.
You kind of need those, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You think the pre will? They think that it'll map touches?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I haven't looked at it that closely yet.
Right.
And, if I get one and play with it, we'll see.
Well, it comes out a week from Saturday. So just 3 days before Apple presumably will announce its iPhone third generation. Dan's book is Bricklin on Technology. It's on bookstores everywhere, but maybe just go to bricklin.com for a copy.
Yep.
That's Dan's log, which is his blog. They call it Bricklin's Log. And also your podcast is there, too. And Dan's got some great interviews on his podcast. Highly recommended.
Well, thank you. Some of which are transcribed in the book.
Even better.
Even better.
Double up. Bricklin, BRICKLIN.com. John C. Dvorak is at Dvorak, channeldvorak.com, but you also see him on Cranky Geeks. And you're still doing that No Agenda and Tech 5?
Of course, Tech 5, No Agenda, all this stuff. But, it's all kind of summarized and available for everybody at channeldvorak.com. I mean, if they want to go to the blog, they can go there, dvorak.org/blog. But Channel Dvorak seems to have picked up the slack for, what am I up to?
And thank you for helping me become a meme.
You are now. We ran the thing of you falling in. By the way, I see you bouncing off the ball again today.
It's a new ball. It's a special burst ball.
Oh, was it filled with foam or something?
Yeah, it's got that slime that bicyclists use, so it can never break.
So anyway, we blogged you first collapsing, and then we blogged the cat one. So, I think it's a good one.
Yeah, I have to thank Mal Brown Cow, who's an editor at Revision 3, for merging my stability ball explosion with the cat that plays the piano, play him out, keyboard cat, and it's quite a good mashup, I think.
Yeah, it's fun.
John C. Dvorak, channeldvorak.com, and of course the blog is dvorak.org/blog. Dan, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. We'll see you soon.
My pleasure.
And thank you, John, and thank you all for being here. Reminder, you can catch the show, of course, live. We do it live every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. That's 2000 UTC at live.twit.tv. And, of course, you could download it after the fact from twit.tv or in the iTunes podcast section. It's free, or the Zoom store. And if you subscribe there, you'll get each and every episode I apologize for screwing up the feed last week. I put a different show on the feed. It's all better now. That's a good tip. If anybody wants to raise their podcast rankings in iTunes, because I screwed up the feed, everybody resubscribed and I got to number 10 in the iTunes podcast store. We haven't been there in years.
Well, that's interesting.
Just shows you. Just screw up your feed once in a while. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Another twit.
This is amazing.
Is in the can.
Round the horn.